Hello, welcome to The Wire, independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station right around Australia. I'm Dan Butler in Sydney, and coming up on The Wire today...
Thousands have been killed since 2016 when the so-called war on drugs was launched.
The 45th session of the UN Human Rights Council begins today in Geneva, on the agenda turning a spotlight onto human rights violations in the Philippines, with President Rodrigo Duterte's regime accused of encouraging violence, harassment and murder. Also on the program tonight...
And what about... Indigenous charities, for example?
If they're an organisation, they still need to contact us, and then we assess it on a case-by-case basis.
The Senate hearing into the copyrighted use of the Aboriginal flag got underway today. Indigenous groups have slammed what they say is the commercialisation of their culture. Stay tuned for all this and more coming up on The Wire. But first... Last week, we brought you a story about a health initiative in the Tiwi Islands that put ear care in locals' hands. This week, we're diving deeper into the Indigenous ear health issue and looking at newly designed assessment tools that are culturally informed. The diagnostic tools were developed by the National Acoustic Laboratory, the Research Division of Hearing Australia, and launched last Wednesday. With Indigenous children 5 times more likely to be diagnosed with middle ear disease than non-Indigenous children, the culturally appropriate tools are aimed at identifying hearing problems before they cause permanent hearing loss. Kelsey Menzies has the story.
The tools are designed like a questionnaire, asking a set of questions with a score which is then used to identify possible hearing problems. Sounds easy, right? Well, they are, but that's what makes these tools so important. They are designed by and for Indigenous communities, a trend which has become current only in the last 4 years. Nikita Dean, Aboriginal Research Officer with Hearing Australia, explains why these tools are so useful in diagnosing middle ear disease, a disease with distressingly high rates in Indigenous communities.
I see the struggles in families, especially not knowing where to go. Me and the audiologist will go into our community and bring our service to families, which makes it so much easier because transport is such a big thing. Not everybody has transport. Not everyone has cars. Not everyone has money. It definitely makes it easier for families bringing it to them, especially if you have more than 5 kids. When everyone found out, like, Nikita's working with Hearing Australia, it made it more of a conversation in my community and more families were like, I noticed we're saying, oh, like, I'm so glad that, you know, you're coming out here more because we didn't even know where to go.
Samantha Harkis, Principal Audiologist for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Services at Hearing Australia, says the tools were developed out of a need for accurate and accessible diagnostic tools.
So there has been no structured way of really having a good conversation about what a child's hearing is like in everyday settings. There was a need to develop something that worked, that had an acceptable level of accuracy, that could be used easily in a health centre or an early childhood centre. It's actually meant to support a conversation between the health worker and the parent and carer, or the early childhood worker and parent and carer.
So why are culturally appropriate tools so important in Indigenous healthcare? Well, Associate Professor and Ear, Nose and Throat Surgeon Dr. Kelvin Kong said it really does come down to common sense.
If you've got a community that's predisposed to this and obviously are affected by this, then we should be directing our treatment as well as our access to patients through that area. And far more, and particularly in this climate in the Black Lives Matter area, we're finding out more and more that there are inherent implicit bias in access to healthcare across the board. And part of that, obviously, with our paediatric population or our kids, is that it just means that general accessibility is very low. And so it's really important for us to predominantly cause a focus to be toward the children and be toward our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children. If you were to fix someone's hearing, you're going to change their life forever. And that means their employment, that means their long-term prospects. And most important, which I talk about, is just the ability of any kid born in Australia having the right to dream.
Samantha echoes this sentiment, saying how accessibility is key in getting people the services they need.
You know, it's wrong to think about how families access the system. The story should be around how do you bring the system, in inverted commas, to cross paths with those families. So the website's fresh and new. Health workers, doctors, early childhood workers can just create a free account and they can actually go in and use an online version. But yes, the people that we really want to access them are health and early childhood workers so that they can have those supported, lovely conversations with parents.
On the ground, Nikita has seen the benefits of the tools play out in real life, not only in Indigenous communities, but non-Indigenous communities as well. A significant leap forward for inclusive healthcare methods.
In Perth, I've been using it on Indigenous and non-Indigenous kids. I've noticed both families enjoy it, you know. So, you know, the Indigenous families really, really like it. And then the non-Indigenous families like it just as much. This is why I like being part of this project so much, is because my voice is important.
Nikita Dean, Aboriginal Research Officer at Hearing Australia, finishing that story by Kelsey Menzies. The 45th session of the UN Human Rights Council begins today in Geneva. Amongst the resolutions to be discussed will be a call for the Council to follow up on recent recommendations relating to human rights violations in the Philippines. The Duterte regime is accused of actively encouraging and condoning extrajudicial killings, violence and harassment, mainly in the context of a war on drugs, but also targeting human rights activists, journalists and trade unionists. A campaigning trade union body in Australia, Union Aid Abroad, is calling on Foreign Minister Marisa Payne to add her voice to the call for action at the Human Rights Council meeting. Rob Osborne has more.
The recommendations for action on human rights abuses in the Philippines stem from a detailed UN report released in June this year.
Thousands have been killed since 2016, when the so-called War on Drugs was launched. We've also managed to document the killings of at least 248 human rights defenders, journalists, trade unionists and lawyers in relation to their work.
That was UN Representative Ravina Shamdasani describing the findings in the report. Union Aid Abroad is an Australian trade union-based international campaigning organisation. Concerned about the human rights situation in the Philippines, and in particular the persecution and murder of trade unionists, Union Aid Abroad delivered a petition to the office of Foreign Minister Maurice Payne on Friday. Tom Reddington, international organiser for the Philippines, explains.
We believe in international solidarity, not charity. So we work with trade unions and social movement organisations to support their struggle for justice, equality and rights overseas. So in the Philippines, we work with a number of trade union centres as well as human rights organisations to support them in their struggles. Today, we're delivering a petition to Maurice Payne, the Australian Foreign Minister. And what we want is we want Australia to show leadership in our region. And at the upcoming UN Human Rights Council, which begins on Monday, we want Australia to sponsor a motion in order to hold the Philippines government to account, to ensure that human rights, trade union rights are respected in the country, and that the extrajudicial killings and persecution stops immediately.
Elmer Labog is a prominent national trade union organiser in the Philippines and is the chairperson of the May the 1st Labor Centre. I asked him why the International Trade Union Confederation has regularly listed the Philippines amongst the 10 countries in the world where trade union rights are the most difficult to exercise.
It's not a normal thing to do a trade union work in the Philippines currently, because you'd be easily branded as a terrorist or anti-government activist. Only on September 7, the vice president of Piston, which is the Federation of the Jeepney Drivers in the Philippines, had been arrested on trumped-up charges. He was brutally manhandled by 20 police and military officers, and a sling bag has been forcibly hung around his neck. And when he checked with the arresting officers the contents of the bag, and it had a pistol and grenade.
The UN investigation into the Philippines also refers to weapons being planted by security forces, pointing out that numerous guns allegedly found in the possession of drug dealers killed by the police are listed in official reports as having the same serial number. Labog says that the persecution of trade union activists has increased recently through a process known as red tagging, where union leaders and members are spied on, arrested and detained for long periods of time. He believes the public display of posters with photographs of unionists identified as red terrorists has contributed to the spate of murders. Elmer Lebog again.
Even before the imposition of the anti-terrorism law this year, we have had the victims of killings, for example, in Mindanao under the banana union of the banana plantation called Sumifro. Danny Bautista was killed while he was at the market buying food for our members at the banana plantation who were then on strike. One of the former Secretary General of the Urban Poor Organization, called Kadamay, he has been killed only a few months back in Leyte Province. So these are some of the current situation where trade unionists are being murdered for the exercise of their trade union rights.
Elmer Lebog, trade union leader in the Philippines, ending that report from Rob Osborne. A public hearing for the Senate Select Committee into the Aboriginal flag was held today, following months of controversy over who should have control over the commercial use of the Aboriginal flag. The debate over copyright for the flag was raised last year after several Indigenous-owned organisations were issued legal letters demanding they stop using the Aboriginal flag on their merchandise because it violated Australian copyright laws. The responses from experts today have also raised the inadequacies of copyright law to deal with a work that has so much cultural, historical, and symbolic significance. Kate Atkinson has the story.
For the first time since the controversy over the use of the Aboriginal flag began, representatives from WAM Clothing have spoken publicly about their company's role in determining the commercial use for the Aboriginal flag. Mr. Ben Wooster and Ms. Samil Moore, both directors of WAM Clothing, were questioned today by senators during the public hearing for the Senate Committee into the Aboriginal flag. Their responses left little doubt over their ability to control who has permission to use the Aboriginal flag on clothing.
So individuals are able to use and fly the flag, correct?
Pursuant to the Copyright Act, yes, and the Flags Act.
Yep, okay. And what about Indigenous charities, for example?
If they're an organisation, they still need to contact us, and then we assess it on a case-by-case basis.
Okay. And then businesses who want to use the flag for commercial use would then need to engage with you and or make a payment?
Yes, they would.
Okay.
The copyright for the Aboriginal flag is currently held by the flag's designer, Harold Thomas.
Because of the way that the Aboriginal flag was created, it was developed as part of the land rights movement.
Isabella Alexander is a professor of law at the University of Technology, Sydney, specialising in copyright law.
And it developed this following and people strongly identified with it. It was declared an official flag, but for whatever reason at the time that happened, no thought was given to the copyright of it, or if there was thought given to it, it was not taken seriously. So even though it was an official flag, copyright was still held by the artist. So that's kind of set up a really unusual situation where he can control the uses of the flag, even though it's an official flag.
But Thomas has leased the reproduction rights to several companies, including WAM Clothing, who now hold exclusive rights to use the flag on clothing. Labor has announced plans to draft a private member's bill to ensure the flag can be used freely. Other copyright experts have suggested that legislation could be passed so that copyright for the flag ceases entirely and the work becomes part of the public domain.
Another option, again, once you've purchased the copyright, it could be held by an Indigenous-controlled entity, which is the case with the Torres Strait Islander flag. Another option would be to, you know, really, I think, looking to Aboriginal jurisprudence and solutions would be another really important way forward. As, again, I think it was mentioned, what do Indigenous people actually want to do with their flag? What's the heart of the dispute here? Kind of working that out is the first step to working out then what the solution can be that can, again, kind of try and address everybody's interests. It's really hard to find a solution that everyone's going to be 100% happy with.
Despite these suggestions, Professor Alexander says that this debate demonstrates how inadequate our copyright law is when copyrighted works end up as cultural symbols, icons, or flags.
I think some of the most important things were when we heard from the legal experts, and they were really emphasising that copyright is the background to this problem and this dispute, but it probably can't actually offer us It can offer a solution, but it probably can't offer a solution that everyone is happy with, because copyright does a very specific thing. It allows people to commercialise artworks, but this is a flag and it raises so many other kind of issues about culture and symbols and the way that people identify with things. So there's a lot of interest here, aside from the interest of Mr. Thomas. His interests are really important, he's the artist, but there's lots of other interests that have to be kind of taken into account, and how you can resolve the tension between those people who want to use the flag in various different ways and Mr. Thomas's ability to control reproductions is the tension at the heart of this, and probably have to go beyond copyright law to ask Indigenous people what solutions that they want.
Isabella Alexander, Professor of Law at the University of Technology, Sydney, ending that report by Kate Atkinson.
The Wire. Independent news and current affairs for the last 15 years and still going strong.
Amidst COVID-19 restrictions, concerns related to mental health have skyrocketed, and with good reason. This has placed significant importance on the work of mental health campaigns like Are You OK Day, who have had to shift their approach almost entirely online. A study by Monash University found that the majority of people show mild levels of anxiety and depression, whilst 30% displayed moderate to high levels since lockdown. So, this year's Are You OK Day campaign has aimed to help everybody who is suffering, despite the difficulty of connection in these pandemic times. Mark DePauli has more.
Since 2009, the not-for-profit organisation Are You OK have aimed to prevent people from suiciding. Their simple message is to ask somebody, Are you OK? Now, in 2020, their annual Day of Awareness is likely to be the most crucial one yet, with COVID-19 worsening individual well-being and spiking mental health concerns nationally. Even prior to 2020, Lifeline stated that 8 Australians are lost every day to suicide. Are You OK Day was held 4 days ago and is predicted to be a success. The message that prolonged the campaign was, there's more to say after Are You OK, encouraging people to educate themselves and help those around them. Professor Philip Batterham, a researcher from ANU who is on Are You OK Scientific Advisory Committee, explains what this year's message was designed to inspire.
It's important for people to understand what to do when people aren't OK, particularly this year in the middle of the COVID crisis. There's a higher risk that people are struggling due to the indirect effects of COVID, due to lockdown, due to financial struggles or unemployment or a range of other reasons.
Professor Nicholas Proctor is the Chair of Mental Health Nursing and Leader of the Mental Health and Suicide Prevention Research Group from the University of South Australia, and he was interviewed as part of Are You OK's promotional campaign. He talks of why this campaign has been so significant.
Australia's been through so much. We had an extensive and devastating bushfire season that rolled into the COVID era where people's lives changed dramatically. The Are You OK message is a reminder about the powerful role of human connection. We can get a message out there to encourage each of us to reach out, connect, ring someone up, set up a video call, arrange a way to connect with another person, and rather than avoid that conversation, have that discussion with somebody where they might say, well, look, no, actually, I'm not okay. And you don't need to be an expert to reach out and connect.
Are You OK's approach does not target the individual, but rather empowers those around the sufferer to intervene. It may seem strange, but Professor Batterham suggests otherwise.
Our research suggests that asking the question is a helpful thing for many people. Most people become less distressed if you ask them how they're doing.
Are You OK's campaign included interviews with industry experts, real-life scenario demonstrations, and digital resources, all focused on one thing.
For people who are asking the questions, to be prepared for a response that somebody's not doing OK, and then think about what they can do to support that person.
Despite being forced completely online, Professor Proctor explores the benefit that hosting the campaign digitally uncovered.
It made it possible for people who perhaps were not so familiar with online access to become much more aware, proactively aware, if you like, about the Are You OK message. These events have exposed and exacerbated vulnerabilities for a lot of people. So lots of things have needed to change, and through that process, it's been possible, I think, not to lose the importance of those messages.
Concerns that the question, "Are you okay?" is tone-deaf and far too simplistic have been expressed by some online. However, Professor Batterman sees the educational resources available through this year's campaign as the solution to these worries.
I understand that people might see it as a bit simplistic to just ask the question, but there are many resources available online to support people in asking the question and what to do afterwards if somebody says that they are not doing okay. My hope is that the approach this year will be just as impactful as in previous years.
Professor Proctor is adamant that Are You OK encompasses all people, recognising that
it tells us something that's really important about mental health and wellbeing. It tells us that people are at different places. And people are at different places and different timelines, in different evolutions, and have different needs and wants that may not be universal and won't be universal. What we need to do is be open to that, be accepting of that, and be supportive of that.
The true extent of the campaign's impact remains to be seen. However, all research points towards 2020's Are You OK Day being a much-needed success.
Mark DiPaoli with that story. Well, magpie swooping season is upon us, and many Australians are expected to experience mobbing, that's the technical term, in the coming few weeks. Why do magpies swoop, and what is the best way to avoid such an incident? Tara Hayes has this report.
It's magpie swooping season in Australia. Many of us have had a past encounter we hope never happens again.
A couple of years ago, the street that I was living in, it had a magpie infestation. All roads in and out of my street had about 3 magpie nests on it. I was on a run. It was like the middle of summer. Magpie like went in for a swoop and then just kept swooping me for about 5-10 minutes. I had to dive into a bush to avoid getting pecked.
That's Michaela. She was unlucky enough to experience a mobbing. Many Australians will have a similar experience this month with the swooping season underway. Senior lecturer in ecology and ornithology at Charles Sturt University, Dr. Melanie Massaro, says the most rigorous defending lasts a couple of weeks from when the magpies nest, commonly at the beginning to the middle of September.
A particular nest, it would just only be for a few weeks, like 2 or 3 weeks, but it wouldn't go much longer than that. But then, of course, what happens sometimes is that when birds lose their first clutch, so for example, due to bad weather or a predator taking the eggs, then they will re-nest. And so that's the reason why you can get some magpies to swoop later in the year.
Dr. Massaro says the main reason magpies swoop is to defend their territory.
So effectively, they want a person, a human in this case, who's in the territory, within their territory, to move on. Like literally get away, get further away from the nest. That's what it is. And birds, of course, because they live in a three-dimensional space, will defend a three-dimensional territory. While it might not necessarily be clear to humans where the territory starts and ends, for the birds it's crystal clear on where the territory begins, and then they will swoop you as soon as you are in that territory. So it's a defense behavior of the nest and chicks, because remember, the chicks in the nest or eggs in the nest, they're quite vulnerable to predators. And that's how this behavior has evolved.
Social media site Magpie Alert is set up to track and monitor incidents of aggressive swooping in Australia. So far this year, it has recorded nearly 2,000 attacks and 229 injuries. However, this is likely to be an underestimate as it's difficult to track the exact number of swooping due to many incidents going unreported. Swooping, also known as mobbing, is a behaviour not unique to magpies.
Mobbing is quite common among birds. So most of the time, birds just mob other birds, predatory birds. So even, you know, honey eaters or willy wagtails will even mob other birds. So mobbing is really, really common for many bird species. However, there's only a few groups of birds that actually started mobbing humans, and the most famous ones here in Australia, of course, the Australian magpies.
She says the best way to avoid being mobbed is to avoid the territory.
So if you know that there are magpies nesting, then you can try to avoid their territory during the time when they have chicks. But sometimes, you know, you're not totally familiar with where they have their territories and whether they're swooping at the moment or not, and then that, you know, probably the best thing is to wear a hat or to bring an umbrella and then use that and just walk through the territory. If you find yourself being swooped by a magpie, you try to walk out of the or get out of the territory as quickly as possible. So you don't want to stop and start yelling at the magpie because that will agitate the magpie even further.
Michaela says she hasn't been swooped since the last incident and has taken to avoiding the magpie territory near her home.
If I stop and like stare at it just to see if it'll, you know, swoop or move or go to its nest or something, and then from that I walk around it with a good like 3 metre radius.
Magpie swoop victim Michaela, ending that report by Tara Hayes. That's it for The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au. The Wire is a team effort by 4EB in Brisbane, Radio Adelaide, and 2SER 107.3 here in Sydney. And you can hear us around Australia on your radio, courtesy of the Community Radio Network, or online weekdays. We'll be back again tomorrow, so please tune in again then. I'm Dan Butler. Thanks for your company.
Потому что все в этой команде и говорят, завтра 19-го, что фонд на что выдал, и соответствующим образом вы будете приняты просто просто наказание.